Welcome to The Edges of Lean. I'm Bella Engelbach, and in this podcast, we explore the human and creative side of lean thinking, unusual places where lean thinking is practiced. We meet people who are practicing continuous improvement in many different flavors and styles. So come along with me on a journey to the edges of lean. Episode 3, Continuous Improvement and Mental Health.
I read a statistic yesterday, actually, that floored me, and it said that the WHO said that 800,000 people a year take their own life. 800,000, that's one person every 40 seconds.
Yes, that I knew.
So if this is a, you know, if it's a 1 hour podcast or 1 hour podcast, there's like, no, I calculated that to be 91 people. So 91 people will take their own life every hour. And yeah. Now that just, I knew it was bad. And I know in the UK, you know, it's kind of 18 per day in the UK, but our levels are slightly lower than the average actually, but
yeah, I think we're 20 a day. I was just talking to two gentlemen from the UK this morning, and it's 18 for you and 20 for us. Yeah.
My guests are Gemma Jones and Michelle Dickinson. In lean thinking, we talk a lot about respect for people, and that means we need to understand the physical and mental conditions affecting the people we work with. I know that my training as a lean thinking, continuous improvement professional included very little about how our brains work, and even less about the effects of mental health and mental illness on how our organizations work. But here's some of what the United Nations has said about the effects of mental illness. The global economy loses more than $1 trillion US dollars a year due to depression and anxiety. Depression affects 264 million people in the world. Around half of all mental health conditions start by age 14, and suicide is the second leading cause of death in young people aged 15 to 29. People with severe mental conditions die 10 to 20 years earlier than the general population. Globally, there is less than one mental health professional for every 10,000 people. And all this was before the COVID-19 global pandemic. Clearly, mental illness is widespread and is something the continuous improvement professional needs to be aware of, because it can affect anyone we work with, including ourselves. Michelle Dickinson and Gemma Jones, thank you very much for joining me today on The Edges of Lean. And we're here today to talk about mental health and the continuous improvement professional. But before we get into that, I would love to hear from each of you how you became aware of the need for awareness about mental health in the workplace. So, Michelle, would you like to start?
Michelle E. Dickinson is a passionate mental health advocate, a TED speaker, and a published author of a memoir entitled Breaking Into My Life, about her own healing journey of self-discovery. Michelle also knows firsthand what it feels like to struggle with a mental illness after experiencing her own depression due to challenging life events. Michelle recently concluded her 19-year pharmaceutical career and became an entrepreneur. She specializes in helping organizations increase inclusion, presenteeism, and retention while decreasing employee downtime by cultivating a culture of compassion in the workplace. Learn more about Michelle at michelleedickinson.com.
Sure, I would love to, Bella. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. Thank you for the opportunity. So the need, my goodness, the need. I think I encountered it myself first when I was dealing with my own depression in the workplace and just really wanted there to be more compassion at work for people who have an invisible disability. I had always been an advocate and really cared for people with a mental illness because of my upbringing with my bipolar mom, but it wasn't until I dealt with it myself that I really recognized how many hours a week we're spending at work, and that that place should not be a place that we have to go to and put a mask on. So it's super important that leaders and organizations are in tune with all aspects of their employees, from physical disabilities to invisible disabilities.
Thanks, Michelle. And Gemma, what's your story? How did this come alive for you?
Gemma Jones started her career studying mechanical engineering. She quickly discovered the world of continuous improvement and spent 20 years working to improve processes and systems within various manufacturing industries, including automotive, pharmaceutical, dairy, cosmetics and toiletries, food, and medical devices. She has been a continuous improvement manager numerous times and an operations manager running a factory of over 500 people. Gemma is hugely passionate about manufacturing and strongly believes in lean thinking. She gets such a kick out of coaching and facilitating, especially when she sees the light bulb switch on in someone's head, when they solve a problem, when they realize they have the power to change, or when they get excited about all the improvements they could make. In 2018, Gemma left the world of employment to establish her own business, Spark Improvement, with a mission to help organizations be the very best they can be by switching on as many light bulbs as possible.
So Mice, thank you, Bella. Thank you for inviting me to be on here. My story, my sort of journey in mental health really started about 2 years ago. So I was working for a manufacturing organization as a continuous improvement manager, and a close friend and colleague of mine, who I'd been working really closely with for about 6 months, took his own life. Now, this, you know, it was a huge shock, and he was not the person, you know, I knew he was stressed, but I would have said there was 20 other people more stressed than him at the time. I had never dreamt that he was struggling, let alone that close. And you know, when that happened, and you know, when everybody was told, and when everybody sort of reacted, and you know, it was very difficult to know what to say to people. And I was very conscious that, you know, I wanted to say the right thing and I wanted to help people. And I became aware that I had, you know, very little competence in knowing what to say and how to handle it, how to communicate with people, and also how to make, you know, how to deal with their feelings myself. And I didn't really know where to go, and I didn't really have anybody that I could, you know, that could sort of help me through that. So I started looking online for, you know, what do I say? How do I deal with this? And I sort of found this whole, obviously I was aware that mental health was an issue, but not to that extent. So I sort of uncovered all of these things, lots of resources actually that were available that I didn't know about, but also lots of statistics that really scared me, and that made me think, you know, wow, I really need to up my own competence and my own knowledge in terms of what to do, but also, you know, sort of try and spread that, because I really wasn't aware beforehand.
Right. You know, I'm thinking about my own career as an improvement professional. And one of the things that happens a lot as you're doing this kind of work is you're changing things for people, right? And so you have to be aware of what's the impact of that change on process, what's the impact of that change on organizational alignment. I don't know, Gemma, and Michelle, you could reflect also on your experience, your training as well. I don't know that we are taught or trained to think about the impact of change, even if it's good change that people are involved in, on the people themselves and their stress levels.
Yeah, I mean, I agree absolutely. You know, as a continuous improvement practitioner, you know, we're taught a lot about the tools and the techniques and, you know, what to do in what situation in terms of, you know, what tool is applicable and what will help. but you know, I think we don't always recognize that a lot of these things cause a lot of stress and turbulence for people and individuals, and you know, what sort of things we could be looking out for and what sort of signals we can be, you know, just checking up on people, because sometimes we're completely changing their world, you know, by changing the process that they work in or changing the systems and things that they use. For some people, you know, that's immensely stressful, and we need to be mindful of that. And I don't think that's really talked about in Lean. We do a lot of talking about tools and techniques and, you know, sort of things that we've got to do, but we don't really talk that much about people and their feelings and how they might respond.
Yeah, and I want to build on that. I feel like leaders in general have such a great opportunity to really cultivate a trusting rapport with their employees. It's that leader that is tuned in, that is self-aware themselves, that is conscientious of the impact that change is going to have on their people. And it's keeping the lines of communication open. So if there is excess stress or anxiety around the change, that there's that comfort level that they can have a conversation about it and not feel like they have to just go home and deal with it on their own. And I think therein lies the opportunity, is for leaders to really be able to step up and cultivate trust and open dialogue.
So Michelle, you work with organizations on resilience. Is that part of that resilience preparation?
It really is. I mean, I think, you know, in my resilience program, we talk about self-awareness. We talk about just being aware of how we're feeling. People might be so busy trying to adopt your new process that they're not checking in with themselves. And I think if they check in with themselves and, you know, they've done a good job of cultivating a solid relationship with their leader, it's going to position them to be able to navigate the change more easily and have the results be far better than any other, approach.
I also think that, you know, people can be under stress and be having mental health issues that are nothing to do with change as well. And I think as a continuous improvement practitioner, whether internal in an organization or external, as I am now, I think you're in quite a unique position quite often with a lot of people across the organization. So, you know, in positions I've been in where I've had no direct reports, but I'm working with every department in the organization in some way, and you build up relationships with those people, and you know, you're kind of in that position of, they don't report to you, but very often they will talk to you and, you know, tell you their secrets or talk to you about what's going on or how they're feeling in a way that they might not to their leaders or their managers. And I think that for me was something that really stuck out for me when this happened at the organization I was working for, is I found people coming to me and asking me, you know, for help, because I'd spent so long trying to build up relationships with people across the site, you know, to get them to trust me and respect me and talk to me and, you know, and be engaged with me. So, and I think that's part of it, is noticing, you know, when people are struggling, even if there's no change happening particularly, or there's no major things going on, people can be really struggling for something to do, you know, with outside of work or something very personal. And sometimes they just want someone to speak to. And very often that's not someone that they report to. It's somebody else. And I think CI people in organizations sometimes, you know, can be in that position.
I love your story, Gemma. I love the story about how people informally came to you because you did the work in cultivating those relationships that you felt like a safe place. I mean, looking at, you mentioned to me before we got on this, the statistics of the suicide rate, right? If that's the end game here, if we don't connect more intentionally with one another, if we don't make the courageous question be known, how are you doing, and literally check in on one another, they spend far too many hours in working than they do probably in their personal lives, and they may not have someone at home checking on them.
Yeah.
So if you are the one in imposing change on them, you know, that's a lot to handle. So I think we all can do a better job in the prevention of suicide by just caring as human beings. We are human beings before we are a process, before we are you know, an employee number. Connecting with one another and genuinely caring how people are doing goes so far for everyone.
So Gemma, yes, before we started recording this podcast, you shared this statistic about the number of people in the UK who take their lives every year. And being a continuous improvement practitioner, you calculated out the hourly rate. So can you tell us about that?
So the global rate, you know, this is these are hard numbers to read, to be honest, but the global rate, and this comes from the World Health Organization, is that 800,000 people a year take their own lives. So that's one person every 40 seconds. So, you know, if this is an hour podcast, I think it's slightly less than that, but that's 91 people an hour across the world. You know, the figures for the UK are slightly, you know, the figures in the UK actually look at about 18 per day. I think Michelle, you said that the figures for the US are 20 per day, but you know, it's a phenomenal amount of people. And you know, when you look at it in terms of one person every 40 seconds, to me, that's incredible.
And you compound that with COVID, right? So that is the statistic, but I will tell you that according to the CDC, one in three in America are struggling with anxiety or depression right now because of this pandemic. One in three. And if it's unaddressed, anxiety and depression, then we're going toward your statistic and people are going to not find the hope to stick around. So we got some work to do.
So what do we do in a time where we can't sit across from each other at a table or, you know, spend a moment in somebody's workplace in their cubicle or you know, wherever it is they're working and have that conversation with them? I feel as if that Zoom is fantastic. You can have wonderful conversations, mm-hmm. you know, Zoom or Microsoft Teams or whatever you're using, but you lose that opportunity for the quick chat. Do each of you have some thoughts about how to address that?
Well, I can share with you. Sorry, I was there. You were thinking. I can share with you sort of what I've done, Bella. Like, I work alone in my home office, and I'm single. And in the beginning of the whole experience, I was very isolated. I mean, I got on Zoom calls just to have a 15-minute connection because I felt that if I could see someone's eyes and connect with them, it would help me, and it did. So I think, you know, even informal, it doesn't have to be a formal meeting. It could just be an informal chat. Just having people know that they're being looked after, that there's someone there who wants to know that they're okay. You don't have to get up all into their space and get all you know, intense and say, are you exhibiting signs and symptoms? No, it doesn't have to be like that. It can literally just be, hey, you know, I was thinking about you and I know your situation. Just, you know, how you doing? You need anything? You good? That little bit of care and love can go so far.
Absolutely. I also think there's, you know, there's ways of organizing, you know, Zoom calls and Zoom meetings that aren't meetings. You know, I'm working with an organization now and they have a half an hour session every week that's just, it's like the coffee room or the lunch table, you know, and people take a cup of coffee and they're just chatting. So it's not an organized meeting. There's not an agenda. It's not like you can only speak if someone asks you a question. It's there just for people to chat, you know, and it makes me think, Bella, about our daily check-ins with the Women in Lean group where through the pandemic, we've come together every work day since the beginning. Was it since like the first few weeks of lockdown?
I think it was March, yeah, early March, yeah.
And we've had, you know, there's a daily half an hour where you can just call in. There's no agenda. It's just people to be able to talk. And, you know, there's times I've gone on that when I was struggling and just like, you know, overwhelmed with homeschooling and pandemic and, you know, oh my gosh, what's going to go on? And just chatting to people just, you know, massively made me feel better because I felt like there was other people out in the same situation who, you know, who understood where I was coming from. So I think, you know, if people aren't meeting physically face to face, there's still ways of organizing, you know, a Zoom call that can give people that you know, that connection. Because in a way, I actually think Zoom is almost better in some ways than face to face, because I can see you both directly.
Yeah.
You know, you can look in their eyes and you can see how they're feeling and they're in their environment. And I sort of think you behave a little bit differently. You're a bit more relaxed.
Yeah.
So in a way, I think, you know, if done right, these sort of remote meetings can be as effective, but you kind of have to make them happen because you're not going to accidentally bump into someone on Zoom.
True.
Yeah. I think that's the piece that is missing, the accidentally bumping into somebody. So Gemma, one of the things that you were talking about with the story of your friend and colleague who took his own life was how unprepared you felt to deal with that as a human being and as a continuous improvement practitioner who had this relationship with a lot of people in the organization. What did you do about that? How did you change that situation?
So very quickly, I went off and did some research and I found lots of resources online. I printed things out, you know, specific one was a guide, you know, of how to talk to people who've been recently been bereaved by suicide. And that kind of helped me in terms of, you know, knowing kind of what to say. I mean, really, all it did was just give me a bit of confidence, really, because all I was doing was listening. And, you know, that was what I learned was really the important thing. But what I then did is I went and did a 2-day mental health first aider training course. I did that myself in my own time. It was something that was important to me. It was very low cost, you know, it wasn't a big outlay for me to do that. And it was a phenomenal 2 days, really, really, you know, really eye-opening, covers a lot of ground and really made me feel more confident that, you know, I was capable of sort of giving someone first aid in that situation. So this is not, you're not being a counselor, you're not helping them through their issues. What you're doing is noticing that somebody needs help and then, you know, in the short term, just checking they're okay and then getting them the help that they need. So you're not, you know, you're not trying to, you know, do an operation on someone's broken arm. You're holding them together and you're getting them to the hospital. So it's that kind of analogy. And that was really helpful to me. It really helped me be much clearer in, you know, what should I do and how should I approach this? And it gave me lots of tools and, you know, things that I've used them repeatedly, you know, I've not come across people who are at that sort of point in their life, but, you know, it's given me a much better outlook.
You know, I challenge people, Bella, all the time. And I ask the question, can your company sustain a suicide? To get them to think about proactively what they can be doing. So I come from the lens of what can we be doing proactively to get people in tune with how they're feeling? What can we be doing to get leaders in tune with what to do to cultivate trust and an open dialogue around well-being? So it doesn't get to the point like you had to deal with the loss of a colleague, and now you're picking up the pieces, self-educating yourself to try to be that resource. So I like to work with my clients to say, what can you do to shift your culture, to normalize a conversation, to have leaders sharing what their experience have been so that it gives me permission to be a human being? So I sort of like to look at it more proactively to condition an environment so it's more open to a common conversation about mental well-being.
And that sort of common conversation is really important, isn't it, Michelle? Because it's not just about preventing suicide, which is very important, but it's also actually about employee engagement. Yes. And people being happy to come to work and wanting to contribute the most they can to the organization. What's the impact of mental health on engagement?
I mean, that's the biggest thing. I mean, I'm going to try not to get too passionate about this, but your leader, like your immediate leader is the face of the company to that employee. Your people leaders really need to be well informed and have emotional intelligence because if they lose engagement with an employee who's suffering, they're going to go out on disability. If they're out on disability, it might be under the guise of initially it could be, I have a stomach ache. And we all know, you know, the accuracy of reporting the kinds of disability, right? Because people are embarrassed. They don't want people to know if they're struggling. So it's to your best interest to have your people leaders equipped to be able to support the people so they stay engaged, so they don't go out on disability. Now, what I'm not saying is that your people leaders become therapists, like Emma was saying. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that they are emotionally intelligent, they are connected, there is a trusting rapport, and they're well aware of the resources within the company for their people, so they can support them and lead them to what they need. But keeping them engaged is only going to benefit the department and the environment and them, because an employee who's at least staying connected to something meaningful is going to keep them in their seat.
Right. And I can see, for those of you who are obviously just listening, Jem is nodding her head up and down with a big smile on her face.
There's something I want to say, Bella, and I don't know if you'll want to use it, and it might be that Michelle needs to say whether it's okay. Is that all right? Sorry to if I mess up the recording by asking this.
That's no problem.
So one thing I wanted to add about, you know, when my friend took his own life was afterwards, I was filled with a very deep sense of guilt and, you know, almost shame that he didn't sort of come to us. One of the things that people said repeatedly, and I think it's that they were trying to make themselves feel better actually, was, you know, there's nothing anyone could have done. If he wanted to do it, he was going to do it anyway, Gemma. There's nothing you could have done. And I could not accept that. That, to me, that was not acceptable.
And Michelle, As you're hearing that from Gemma, what's your response?
Yeah, I think as human beings, there's no excuse for someone feeling so hopeless. I would have felt the same exact way you did, Gemma. I mean, we are human beings before anything. And if someone would have talked to you, you might have given them that lifeline. And that's why it's so important to have people continue to talk. Talking could have been so much so prevented if they just spoke about what they were dealing with.
Yeah. And that's, you know, one of the things I learned on the course that I went on, and I've just been looking through my notes today, is that suicidal crises are usually time limited, and they're usually based on unclear thinking. And asking someone directly, you know, about their intentions, or, you know, if they've mentioned something, or if you've noticed some of the sort of warning signs, asking someone directly if this is their intent very often actually lowers their anxiety level and makes it much less likely that they go on to do it. You know, I'm not a professional, so I say that with some caution. But as soon as I learned that, in a way, I felt better, because I felt better about the world. I didn't feel better about him, because I thought, actually, I probably could have, if he told me, I think I could have done something. Not me personally, but I think I could have got him help. But it, you know, it made me feel better about the world generally, that, you know, this isn't just going to happen and there's nothing we can do about it. Right. There is things we can do about it if people talk to each other and if people observe each other closely enough so they can see some of these warning signs. And, you know, they can start to see when people are struggling and actually ask them, are you okay? And then ask them again, you know, are you definitely okay? Because, you know, you kind of don't look okay to me. And sometimes that's, I think, what people need. And they need that connection to know that somebody cares enough.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting what you say, Gemma, about unclear thinking, because one of the things that we try to do in Lean and continuous improvement is to focus on our thinking and to think about how do we improve our thinking and how do we see what's really happening and how do we test out our theories about what's going on. And if somebody is thinking unclearly, is under the impression that things are hopeless for them, then the kind of questions that we use in Lean coaching may be just the kind of questions that we perhaps already know how to ask. We just don't know that we should be asking, and we could be asking them about how somebody's feeling. And again, not to be a therapist, right? Because clearly Absolutely. We're not therapists, but we are people who can help people clarify their thing.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, being a CI practitioner is about asking questions very often. You know, it's not about us having the answer. We don't know the answers to everybody's problems, but we know the questions to ask to help them figure out the answers to those problems, or to help them and their teams figure out the problems. So I think, yeah, I think there's a lot in terms of what we do that actually can, you know, could work quite well. And that's, you know, in terms of figuring out what your if you've got this monumental problem that you just can't see past, you know, there's things we can do to help break that down and help make it seem more achievable. So yeah, I definitely think there's a tie in there.
And I don't necessarily, I love that you took the mental health first aid training, and I think that's wonderful, because you wanted to feel empowered, because that must have been so incredibly painful. I think what the biggest challenge we have is that people look away because it's uncomfortable, and because they assume someone else is going to look after their colleague. And because they also feel like they have to fix it, and they don't have to fix it. All they have to do is be there and ask, are you okay? And that could make all the difference. So I think we all need to understand the power that we have, just as a listener, just as a human being, that we don't have to fix it. So don't look away. Have the courage to ask someone how they're doing, and not assume someone else is going to look after them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's looking around us, looking at the people within our environment, the people that we're in contact with, and noticing and talking. And I do think for some people that's uncomfortable, you know, but like you say, it's just about asking and listening and realizing that you don't have to provide the answers.
Right. But it also goes back to something else, Bella, that we didn't talk about, and that's our own biases. Mm. Our own biases come into our relationship to something like mental health. What we've experienced in our life, or what we've not experienced, or what the media has shaped our mind around mental health is, right? So I think we all could do a better job of just having a basic understanding of what mental health really is, so that we are not so apprehensive about extending and asking someone how they're doing. You know what I mean? Like, I think we have to own that and educate ourselves.
Michelle, what is the prevalence of mental illness?
What do you mean, like the prevalence? And
I mean, when you think about the average person in their lifetime, how likely are they to themselves experience some form of mental illness or mental distress?
Right. So according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, prior to COVID, it was 1 in 5 Americans will experience a mental health imbalance in their lifetime. 1 in 5 will experience something. And it could be short term, it could be chronic, it could be anything. I myself was never diagnosed with a mental illness until I was 46, and a life event came along and challenged me, and I dealt with depression. Temporarily, thank God, it wasn't long term, but I didn't think I would ever deal with it. I mean, I just didn't. But you know what? Nobody's immune to it.
Right. Yeah. I think that's part of the bias, right? Because it feeds on itself. So people don't talk about it. People, as you said, look away. And which means that we feel unfamiliar with it, which creates more, I think, of a sense of discomfort around the topic of mental illness. And, you know, I know in my own family, we have some members of the family who have struggled with various aspects of mental illness. And it's been hard, even within the family, for people to talk about it and to share some of the things that are going on. So doing it in the workplace is even harder. And I think another thing that, and Gemma, I don't know how this plays out in the UK, but in the US, one of the things when I became a people leader that I was trained on was about, you know, that there were certain things that were related to HIPAA that I was not allowed to ask employees about, right? So where is that line? It's not always clear, you know, where is that line, you know, where you can, what can you ask and what can you not ask? So I really like what you say, Michelle, you know, that basic question. Are you okay? Yep. Are you really okay? That's a, you know, that is not stepping over any confidentiality boundaries.
Imagine that employee, Bella, that doesn't have love surrounding them at home. And they're really like, their work is their identity. And someone from their work actually took a moment to say, are you okay? Like, powerful right there. We have to care for one another.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm thinking about some of the resources that are available to people. I'm hoping that people listening to this, especially continuous improvement professionals, are thinking about what's the impact of the work that they do on the people that they work with. I'm hoping people are also thinking about just their own mental health and this time of COVID, of being separated, of stress, of concern about our jobs and the health of our friends and families. Gemma, you talked about the organization where you went for mental health first aid training. And there's an equivalent organization in the US. Michelle, as you said, you don't necessarily have to be trained in mental health first aid to be helpful. But to be helpful, sometimes you do have to connect people to other resources. How might our listeners find those resources to connect to?
In the UK, I don't think it's in the US, but in the UK, there's an app called Hub of Hope. I have it on my phone and it knows where I am. And if I was with someone who needed help, I can go into that app and I can immediately tell them, right, there's a list of, 15 people within 20 miles who can help. And you can help direct people to, depending on what sort of thing they need. So that there's lots of resources out there. But I know that's just for the UK.
Yeah, and I can share. So first of all, shameless plug, I work with companies to really help shift cultures, to have them be more inclusive. So I'm happy to help people. But the other two things in the US that people should know about, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI.org, is a tremendous resource. They have a COVID kit. They have signs and symptoms of depression. If you're concerned about a loved one, you don't know if they're exhibiting signs and symptoms, you can look at their website and get some insight. They also facilitate family support, like groups and sufferers groups where you can get together with different people. And then there's a great resource called 18%, which I was a moderator for. It's 18%.org, 18 written out, or 18, the number, and then percent written out. And that's just a tremendous online, free, anonymous community of people who are just supporting one another through navigating depression or anxiety or whatever they're dealing with. So that's a great resource.
Well, thanks. It's certainly, for me, this has been something that I know that I was aware of, because it certainly has impacted me in the past. I remember one of my very first improvement projects, working with a team of people as an external consultant, and we came up with a process that we thought was really fantastic, and a woman burst into tears and ran out of the room. And I remember having no idea what had just happened or why it had happened. Over the years, I certainly came to realize the impact, both positive and perhaps sometimes stressful, of the work that we do as continuous improvement professionals. Even more than that, as I have learned more about lean and lean thinking and the importance of respect for people and what respect for people can mean, seeing somebody as a whole person and really caring for that whole person, I believe is key to making any organization work. But it's hard work to do that, right? It's not something that that we are all trained to do, or perhaps necessarily even wired to do. What you're saying, Michelle Dickinson, about leaders having to learn to do that is often true. People become leaders, they become a continuous improvement professional sometimes because they're good at a technical skill, yeah, not because they're good at being a people person. If you were to just say one thing to sum up what this learning has meant to you, what would that be? Gemma Jones, do you want to start us off?
What my learning over the last 2 years in terms of...
Yeah.
Really, I think it's all about talking to people and listening to people. And so often we're so busy in the lean world and the continuous improvement world and, you know, just normal industrial world. I think, you know, with people working is, you know, getting on, trying to improve things, trying to improve processes, motoring on, you know, as quick as we can to change processes and make them better. And sometimes that can be at the detriment to people. And I think really it's about kindness and it's about listening and it's about observing people and, you know, and talking to them when you think they need it. Sorry, that's not a few words, is it, Bella?
That was lovely, thanks.
I just think, you know, very often lean is sold as all about tools and all about techniques and all about processes and systems. And we forget about the respect for people that, you know, that's key to all of it. But I think sometimes that gets forgotten because we're in pursuit of, you know, operational excellence, or we're trying to save money, or, you know, we're trying to get this process finished by whatever deadline or whatever customer requirement is. And we sort of see customer as king and, you know, we've got to do everything for the customer. But actually, we've really got to look inside and look at our people and you know, we have a duty of care, I believe, to them, first of all, over and above a customer.
Wow, I really like that, a duty of care to the people. Michelle Dickinson?
Yeah, I would say don't assume that everyone around you is okay.
Yeah.
Check in on each other. Really ask someone how they're doing and be that person that courageously asks, how are you doing? And even if they don't tell you then, they're going to know you're a safe place if they need you.
Definitely. And even if I can add to that, you know, as hard as that might be sometimes to ask that question, it's a lot less hard than standing at that person's funeral. Sorry if that's, you know, yeah. But believe me, it is.
Yeah. And again, you know, that is certainly something that we want to see change, but it also, you see them walk out the door because they left the company because they didn't
have
to for. Or just when they're at work, not fully being there because they don't feel cared for, or that they're struggling with something that they are not able to get help for. So thank you, Gemma. Thank you, Michelle. This has been a really good conversation. And we should talk more about mental health and continuous improvement.
Thank you for having me on, Bella.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, Bella.
This is Bella Engelberg, and I'd like to thank Michelle E. Dickinson and Gemma Jones for being my guests on The Edges of Lean. You can find Michelle at michelleedickinson.com and Gemma at sparkimprovement.co.uk. To learn more about mental health first aid training, go to www.mentalhealthfirstaid.org in the US, and in the UK, go to https://mhfaengland.org. If you or someone you know are having suicidal thoughts, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24 hours a day in the U.S. at 1-800-273-8255. In the U.K., you can ring the Samaritans on 116-123, also 24 hours a day. Additional suicide prevention resources can be found on the NHS website. Please join me in exploring more of The Edges of Lean. There's a lot to learn. The Edges of Lean is written and produced by Bella Engelberg. This is a Lean for Humans production.